I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Thank you for joining us today. So this session is on lessons from Australian First Year Insurance climate-related disclosures. Our speakers are Shweta Krishna, who is a Director of Actuarial Services at EY, and Andy Kanchik, who was a Senior Manager of Actuarial Services also at EY. Please add questions into your app as we go, or feel free to kind of share them after the session. It'll be about a 35-minute session and then around 10 minutes for Q&A.
Thank you, Khalees, for the kind introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Purpose of today's session is to share insights from the first wave of Australian insurers' climate-related disclosures prepared under AASB S2. This is a new mandatory climate reporting regime and represents a really significant milestone for our market, with climate reporting moving from a largely voluntary exercise to a mandatory basis for the first time. In terms of agenda for today, we look to provide a quick overview of the legislative requirements and the benchmarking process that we've gone through. Then we'll step through the key insights covering the key pillars of AASB S2, covering governance, strategy, risk management, and metrics and targets. And finally, we'll look to just share our key takeaways and learnings. So firstly, what is AASB S2? AASB S2 is the climate-related disclosure standard issued by the Australian Accounting Standards Board, AASB. It's essentially the Australian equivalent of the global standards issued by ISSB, or the International Sustainability Standards Board, IFRS S2. Objective of ISSB here has been to create a global baseline to replace the voluntary frameworks with the objective of improving the transparency, improving the comparability of information for investors and other users of climate-related disclosures. Just in terms of what entities are within scope for this, so in terms of the table that we've got on the left that sets out how the new obligations are being phased across the three various groups of entities. So this is determined by essentially a size threshold. That size threshold is in turn determined by a measurement of number of employees, total assets, and revenue. The entities in Group 1 are the first tier of reporters, and they are required to report for reporting periods commencing 1st January 2025 onwards. So the Group 1 entities with year ending 31 December 2025 have now reported under the new mandatory disclosure requirements, and the focus of our benchmarking is very much these first Group 1 reporters. Also just noting that the June and September reporters are still due to report, so this will reflect our early learnings. Secondly, in terms of what assurance requirements apply, so that's set out, represented in that table on the right-hand side that you've got there. Assurance requirements are also being phased in, and within the first year, limited assurance applies to certain components of the sustainability reports. So this covers scope 1 and 2 emissions, governance, and then certain aspects of the strategy disclosures. And then in subsequent years, year 2, year 3, limited assurance is required across the full report before moving to reasonable assurance in year 4 onwards. It's also worth noting that scope 3 emissions, they're not a first-year reporting requirement. And that table is also not to be confused with what the reporting requirements are. In year one, companies are still required to produce the full disclosure report with the exception of Scope 3 reporting. So that's presenting the assurance requirements. So just in terms of the benchmarking we conducted, we focused on 12 reports across insurers and reinsurers from Group 1. This represents in terms of the sector coverage. It comprises life insurers, general insurers, reinsurers, and one health insurer. And in terms of the structure of the benchmarking, we followed a structure aligned with the key pillars of AASB S2 reporting. So we've got insights covering governance, strategy, risk management, and then metrics and targets. So the objective of the exercise is very much to step back and learn what we can learn as a market, extracting practical insights around how insurers have approached AASB S2 requirements, understand where the industry is at today, and where the next phase of the maturity needs to focus, and also how actuaries can assist the industry in moving beyond minimum compliance. So with that context in mind, I'll hand over to Andy, who will cover the governance and strategy pillars.
Thanks, Shweta. So when we talk about governance in a AASB S2 context, we refer to the structures that support how climate-related risks and opportunities are reported on at the board and management levels and the policies that embed the management of climate-related risks and opportunities throughout the organisation. At the board level, the boards of these insurers have ultimate climate-related accountability and provide oversight. In most cases, climate-related reporting has been incorporated as a standing agenda item into existing board meetings, which for most of the insurers is quarterly. The scope of climate-related reporting to the board currently includes input from across the business. This is because at the management level, a limited number of insurers currently have a local chief sustainability officer or equivalent role. For some insurers, with global parents, the role exists within group, while others have a local head of sustainability or equivalent role, which reports into other executives. So in most cases, what that means is climate-related responsibility is shared between key executives, such as the CEO, who typically looks after the overall strategy execution, the CFO, typically tasked with the external reporting and disclosure requirements, and the CRO, who generally looks after the monitoring against risk appetite. So while the responsibility is shared, interestingly, only a handful of insurers currently link executive remuneration to climate-related outcomes. In the absence of a centralized CSO role, the need for strong governance practices is heightened where climate-related responsibilities are shared amongst executives. Going forward, insurers will need to ensure ownership and responsibilities are clearly articulated and understood across the organisation. This will ensure more effective board reporting, allowing boards to fulfil their obligations in relation to climate statement disclosures over time. We distill climate strategy into four key parts. What are the insurer's key climate-related risks and opportunities? Over what time horizon are they expected to manifest? How material are they expected to be? And what are the insurer's strategic initiatives to address them? So, what are the key climate-related risks and opportunities that insurers have identified? For general insurers, unsurprisingly, the increasing frequency and severity of weather-related events was the most significant physical risk identified. While for life insurers, the most commonly identified physical risk was the longer-term impact on mortality and morbidity rates, including rates of mental health claims and diseases from changing weather conditions. A number of life insurers similarly identified the increasing frequency and severity of weather events, but less materially, due to the potential operational disruptions these events may create for insurers. Pretty consistently, longer-term insurance affordability and availability was also recognised by a number of insurers as a key physical risk. Meanwhile, failing to transition to a low-carbon, net-zero economy was the most commonly identified overarching transition risk, and in two ways. Firstly, through insurers' investment portfolios and the potential exposure to high-carbon emission industries or risks, and secondly, through heightened regulatory, legal, and reputational risk associated in their own operations and failing to transition appropriately. Meanwhile, the key opportunities identified included developing new products or services, investing in and innovating new solutions, and building greater public resilience and awareness. So while we do observe some commonality in the types of climate-related risks and opportunities identified by the 12 insurers, there is still a large degree of variability in the risks and opportunities insurers expect to impact on their climate strategies. Insurers to date have also focused primarily on the risk side rather than the opportunities side. AASB S2 requires entities to clearly define time horizons. So, following on from the previous slide, over the short term, the increasing frequency and severity of weather-related events is expected to be most pronounced, particularly for general insurers, which most insurers have defined as being within the next 3 years and aligns with current business planning cycles. Insurers expect the risks associated with failing to transition to a low-carbon or net-zero economy to manifest over the medium term. Most insurers have defined medium term as being within the next 10 years and have aligned this timeframe with a range of measures, including the duration profile of some longer-tail insurance liabilities, decarbonisation targets, and in some cases, longer-term strategic planning periods. Longer term, insurers expect chronic physical risks associated with changing weather conditions, for example, rising sea levels, temperature changes, precipitation levels, and the like, to have the most material impact, particularly for life insurers. All insurers have defined long term as being beyond the next 10 years and in some cases up to 25 years. Insurers have typically aligned this time period with current long-term climate commitments, such as 2050 net zero targets. So while there is some variability with how insurers have defined short and medium term, the greatest variability still exists in how insurers are considering long-term. This is unsurprising given the inherent uncertainty associated with assessing climate-related risks and opportunities over such extended time horizons. So the standard pretty clearly defines materiality as whether climate-related risks and opportunities could reasonably affect prospects across the value chain. However, what we observed is that the assessment of materiality remains quite subjective still. There is no currently prescribed methodology, and in practice, most insurers are still relying predominantly on qualitative overlays. For the 7 insurers that have incorporated some quantification into the materiality assessment, this quantification is largely short-term focused and simplified. About half of insurers identified at least one material inherent exposure, and it's important to note that we're talking on an inherent basis before allowing for any sort of management actions as part of that materiality assessment. But the other 50% currently deem no climate-related risks to be material. For general insurers, the story is relatively consistent. Physical risks are expected to have the most material impact. But importantly, this is viewed through a managed lens. As I mentioned earlier, actions such as pricing, underwriting and reinsurance acting as key mitigation levers available to insurers to help mitigate some of these risks. For life insurers, though, it's much less convergent. Mortality and morbidity risks, policyholder behaviour and asset exposures were all identified by different insurers as their most potentially material risk. While insurers aren't seeing transition risks as being the most material, importantly, they are recognising the opportunities that they may present. Although this is not expected to translate into short-term financial upside. What is evident is that the assessment of materiality is still largely qualitative, with the absence of robust long-term quantification reflecting both modelling limitations as well as the inherent uncertainty in climate pathways. What we actually found was that in New Zealand, which has had mandatory disclosures for several years now, the number of material climate-related risks and opportunities disclosed actually reduced over time as approaches to assess materiality matured. Similarly, over time, Australian insurers will be expected to enhance the assessment of materiality and the outcomes may change as a result. So to round out the discussion on strategy, we finish off with strategic initiatives. How are insurers incorporating climate-related risks and opportunities into their decision-making and long-term business planning? As you can see from the graph, strategic initiatives are mostly concentrated in the areas of product and pricing, as mentioned previously, thinking about new products or innovations to existing products, investments in green or sustainable assets, and through some of the supporting functions, particularly in relation to operations and how insurers are thinking about decarbonising their own operations over time. Interestingly, very few insurers are currently thinking about strategic initiatives in the areas of claims management and distribution. One insurer did identify embedding sustainability into claims processes as an opportunity, but did not go on to describe this in great detail. Similarly, as I mentioned earlier, a number of insurers identified building greater resilience and public awareness as a key climate-related opportunity, but have not directly linked this to how it could be potentially influenced through the distribution function. In addition, insurers are required to disclose the amount of capital deployed for strategic initiatives in the current reporting period. In 2025, most insurers explicitly disclose deployment of no or immaterial amounts of capital towards climate-related strategic initiatives. The exception was one insurer who explicitly set aside $612 million of capital for investment into green and sustainable assets. To date, only a handful of insurers have developed a transition plan to support delivery of their climate initiatives, which Shweta will cover off in a later slide. So while it is evident that insurers are considering different strategic initiatives to address climate-related risks and opportunities, embedment of these strategic initiatives into key decision-making and long-term business planning remains at the early stages of maturity. Actuaries will clearly have a role to play across the strategy pillar beyond just enhancing quantification, as insurers move towards operational execution of these strategic initiatives over time. I'll now pass back to Shweta to talk through risk management and metrics and targets.
Thanks, Andy. In terms of risk management, first thing we considered was scenario analysis. Scenario analysis is pretty central to AASB S2 requirements. Australia is a bit unique compared to the rest of the world, where regulation requires at least two mandatory scenarios. So there is a requirement to look at a 1.5 degree temperature increase scenario, and then there is a higher warming scenario that must exceed 2 degrees with 2.5 degrees stated as an example that would meet this criteria. So what we observed with respect to scenario analysis was, while insurers in Australia have extensive modeling capabilities as a part of their core business, this is not necessarily translated into first-tier reporters adopting fully quantitative approaches with respect to scenario analysis. And that's evidenced through the graph that we've got on the left there, where we noted one-third of the entities within our sample adopted purely qualitative approaches, and the remaining two-thirds have adopted a combination of a qualitative and a quantitative approach. In terms of physical versus transition risk, we noted a consistent theme. Physical risk quantification was more mature compared to transition risk. In terms of sector-level differences, again, quantification is more mature for general insurers in the physical risk space compared to life insurers. We also considered how this looks like in terms of different time horizons, and in terms of the confidence with respect to longer term horizons. There's a number of limitations that are recognized in forecasting for these long term horizons. Just in terms of better practice, we observed those who were more mature in their approaches, they were providing better transparency around the limitations, more explicit discussion of the modeling constraints and data gaps. They're also providing a more explicit link between the results of the scenario analysis and how this ties in with the business impacts. So how this informs your underwriting strategy or the investment allocation or decisions around your capital adequacy and reinsurance decisions. We've also considered how the entities are assessing and demonstrating resilience under climate scenarios, which is, again, a core requirement of AASBS2. Specifically, we asked the question whether entities were explicitly concluding whether their business models remain resilient and how that resilience is demonstrated. What we see here was almost all insurers, more than 80%, explicitly concluded that their business model did remain resilient against climate-related risks. Important nuance here is resilience conclusions are often high-level. They're not typically tied to quantitative thresholds or a clear pass-fail metric, so resilience is often asserted based on a qualitative evidence base. When we looked at the time horizons over which resilience is demonstrated, again, we observed generally these are tied to more shorter or medium-term horizons, and there's less clarity on the longer-term horizons. There was also a clear difference between subsectors, again, similar to previous themes we noted. General insurers, reinsurers tended to have stronger articulation of the resilience, often linked to catastrophe modeling, underwriting controls, and life and health insurers were more heavily relying on qualitative assessments. Additionally, what we observed with resilience was it is conditional on a number of underlying assumptions, so the continued ability for insurers to reprice, availability and affordability of reinsurance, maintenance of the capital buffers, and functioning insurance markets. So some pretty large assumptions there, which underpin the resilience conclusions. Yeah, we see over here an opportunity for actuaries to support the entities in moving from a narrative conclusion to a clear, measurable resilience conclusion, which is linking the scenarios to financial drivers, management action, and consequently the impacts on the business models. In terms of risk management integration, we looked at the extent to which climate risk is being integrated into enterprise risk management frameworks and processes across the 12 insurers. Specifically over here, we've looked at four areas: risk appetite, risk taxonomy, stress testing, and the internal capital adequacy assessment process or the ICAP processes. And at a very high level, what we see is that climate is now clearly getting embedded within the ERM frameworks through risk appetite statements and risk taxonomy. But that depth of integration really varies across the market. Integration is strongest at the governance and framework level, but it's yet to be fully operationalized in decision-making through stress testing frameworks and the ICAP and capital processes. Just in terms of a bit of context for this slide, AASB S2 requires entities to disclose information on current effects as well as anticipated effects on your financial position, financial performance, and cash flows. And these needs to be explicitly mentioned for the short, medium, and long term. And this is very much designed to complement the information that sits within the financial statements. What we observed here was while half of the insurers disclosed only qualitative anticipated financial impacts in the first year of AASB S2 reporting, the remainder, they moved beyond narrative to varying degrees. Most stopped at directional or descriptive financial impacts, with only a very small subset clearly translating climate scenarios into quantified outcomes or financial decision making. Again, highlighting here where the market practice is heading and where actuarial expertise can materially help lift the disclosure quality in linking climate to the impacts on the financial position, financial performance, and so on. We also observed that quantifying anticipated financial effects over medium to long-term horizons proved pretty difficult in practice. So for example, 5 or 10 years or more than that, that was pretty challenging. And where quantification was not disclosed, a number of limitations have been called out. There's been materiality judgments, challenges in isolating the impacts of climate from the broader other business impacts, and then high levels of uncertainty driven by modeling and data limitations. And again, the need to rely on various assumptions that are both dynamic and inherently uncertain, including decarbonization pathways, market behavior, demand shifts, technological developments, and government policy settings. In terms of metrics and targets, we've looked at Scope 3 reporting. So while material Scope 3 emissions are not required to be disclosed in the first year of mandatory reporting, we thought it'd be interesting to look at which insurers have disclosed this on a voluntary basis. So all entities that we looked at, they applied transition relief for Scope 3 in the first year, which is available. And just for context, Greenhouse Gas Protocol has 15 separate categories of Scope 3 emissions, including Category 15 investments, which currently includes financed emissions. From what we observed, a very small proportion of entities have reported the Scope 3 emissions and on a voluntary basis so far, and this is quite heavily focused on the operational categories with with no information disclosed in relation to financed emissions. And from our conversations with the market, we noted that this will remain a pretty challenging area for companies. Emissions arising from the value chain are not within the control of the entities, so data availability, quality have been the key barriers for entities. The lack of counterparty data, value chain emissions data, and this is also coupled with methodologies evolving. So key takeaway here is to start early on this journey because it could require amendments to your contracts, accessing new data, use of specialist resources. It will likely require the extensive use of judgments and estimates initially, and with this evolving as more direct information becomes available. ASIC, in the recent release as well, they called out the need for clear, effective, and proximate disclosures of relevant judgments, assumptions, and areas of measurement uncertainty, which should be noted down. Stepping through targets and transition plans, targets are not mandatory under AASB S2. However, AASB S2 requires an entity to disclose this information about any targets that have been set. What we observed here was 2/3 of the entities disclosed emission reduction targets within the disclosures, but coverage of this is pretty uneven. It's mainly covering your scope 1 and 2, and very few entities are extending this to fully cover scope 3, again indicating that full value chain target setting, it remains an emerging area of the standard. For a large proportion of the entities, the targets are also group-driven. So the entities, they are yet to own and fully operationalize these targets at a local entity level. Very few reporters explicitly referenced independent validation of the targets as well. In terms of transition plan, again, we observed that only 1/3 of the entities had formal transition plans in place, indicating that transition plan, again, remains an emerging area of maturity. So overall message here is firms want to signal that they have ambition, but the measurement architecture around targets, transition plans is still being built. So just stepping back from the detail, what does it all mean for the market? The first year of insurers' AASB S2 disclosures signal that the first year reporters have met the compliance requirements, and this has required significant effort from the industry. It's been a lot of heavy lifting. And while the standardized disclosures have improved comparability and consistency, these remain at an early stage of maturity. For organizations that are yet to report, early lessons highlight the level of discipline required for the disclosures and the extent to which many organizations who really underestimated the effort and resourcing. So what this means for Group 2, Group 3 reporters is starting early, investing in the data systems controls that underpin it, having a clear view of roles and responsibility, who within the finance team is the owner, ensure there's a bridge between your sustainability function and the finance function, test and documenting key judgments, assumptions, significant areas of uncertainty clearly. Make sure you've got the appropriate sign-off processes, educating relevant board members and board committees. And across all the three pillars, three themes really stood out for us. Firstly, the data capability constraints are underlying almost every challenge that we've discussed today. Secondly, climate risk is getting embedded in governance and risk management, but not yet consistently driving business and strategic decisions. And thirdly, disclosures remain qualitative in a number of respects, particularly when it comes to financial impacts, resilience, scenario analysis. So we do see a shift towards greater quantification and sophistication with scenarios, stronger linkages to financial outcomes and capital. And lastly, more maturity with respect to scope 3 emissions measurement and transition planning. In terms of all the gaps we are seeing, we do see that the actuarial skill sets would be quite relevant. The actuarial profession does have a critical role in supporting insurers through this transition, bringing analytical rigor, risk modeling expertise, and forward-looking insights to the forefront of climate accountability. Thank you all.
Thank you. That was a really great market scan. There's a few questions from the audience. I might start with where and how have actuaries been involved in climate disclosures so far? You kind of talked about how where we can play more of a role. But to date, is it something where the CFO or CRO or sustainability officer has been owner and driver, or has it been actuarial led?
Sure. Just checking if this...
I think it does work.
Yeah. Working.
Does it?
No.
Do you mind just stepping out?
Yeah, just in terms of answering that question, when we work with different organizations, like my personal experience has been, this is not consistent across the different organizations. Sometimes the role is sitting under the CFO's remit. In other places, it's led by sustainability teams. But what it has required is really working people bringing different parts of the organization, having that cross interdisciplinary team in terms of getting to the mandatory disclosures. It's been a lot of uplift that has been required. There has been external assistance that organizations have seen to get in terms of, like, you know, particular question around like actuaries, where they can play a role. From my perspective, they can play a role across quite a lot of areas that we covered today, in terms of whether it's risk management, whether it's scenario analysis, whether it's climate resilience, whether it's anticipated financial effects. And I think they are playing roles to different degrees in various organizations. I think in the general insurance space, there is a bit more of a direct sort of link between the teams that are involved in catastrophe modeling and translating that to climate impacts. Whereas in the life insurance space, it's almost a sort of new skill set that is required, because life insurers have not had to look at impacts of climate change previously on your mortality, morbidity, lapses. I think insurers are still very much working through this, and there is still, like, because it's been quite qualitative so far, there is still a lot of capacity for insurers to get involved. Anything to add, Andy?
I'm guessing we have more questions.
Oh, there's a lot more questions, so maybe...
Okay.
Next question. Do you see these disclosures changing behaviours? Do you think that insurers are seeing it as more than a compliance exercise? Are investors and customers interested in the results of this reporting?
Can I have a go? I think as the message sort of came through, and probably seen it enough times in recent years, I think it may sound cynical, but at least until insurers are pushed and required to do something, it's not typically sort of top priority and top of the list of things to do. I think, you know, from my experience, I've seen a number of insurers thinking about sort of climate-related risk scenario analysis, integrating it into risk management frameworks for a number of years. But in terms of, you know, when something like this comes along, you know, similar to the way sort of IFRS 17 came along, it really forces insurers to need to act and get up to scratch with what they need to do to meet their requirements. I think naturally, probably not unexpected, there will be a period of sort of transition and developing this capability over time, particularly as the expectations start to get a bit more stronger. But yeah, I think to date, it has probably been sort of, let's just get what we need done. And then sort of from what we see in the market, insurers are now turning their attention. Well, okay, we've done this once. In some cases, insurers did it a year in advance. What can we now do to be doing this better?
We have a question about best practices for disentangling climate risks from other kinds of related risks, like supply chain, affordability, morbidity trends. The concern being that it might underweight the impact that climate might have on these trends, and the impacts are not adequately attributed. Do you have any thoughts?
Is that from a life insurance context? Or?
I think it's a general space industry context.
I think in terms of disentangling effects, I think particularly in life insurance, this is very early stage maturity. There is not a lot of credible evidence-based data that you can rely on. Previous studies, they underestimate the impacts of your heat stress impacts. There's a lot of research going into this space, and I think it will continue to be a space where there's going to be new learnings. In the UK, we've had the mandatory climate reporting regime in place for a few years now, and we are seeing a greater maturity there. EY ran a survey 2 years ago, and because the regulators have increased their expectations over time over there, what we are seeing is a climate scenario is starting to feed into business planning within the life insurance space. Life insurers are using quantitative modeling approaches for scenario assessment. They were using off-the-shelf scenarios. Now they are moving to in-house modeled scenarios. They are exploring how physical risk impacts, again, your lapse, mortality, morbidity rates, your macroeconomic variables, how that feeds into your investment portfolios and so on. So both in the transition risk as well as physical risk, they are taking quantitative approaches. While there'll be lots of judgments initially, I think there is still room for this to mature.
It's probably only time for one more question. I'll ask a question about audit. If you put your auditor hat on, if you have any experience there, just what are the things that you're looking for when you're auditing sustainability reports? Have you had any exposure to that?
Yeah, normally in our roles, we provide expertise on audits as actuaries. But one of the things is that, you know, like in terms of, say, materiality conclusions, I think, again, where there's judgments involved, I think for Group 2 and Group 3 reporters are, you do need to have those, you know, judgments written down. They do need to be substantiated with what you've seen within the business. Then there is like scenario analysis. One of the key topics with our clients has been whether you go qualitative approach versus quantitative approach. And the wording in the standard is it needs to be commensurate with the entity's circumstances. And how do you judge whether that's commensurate or not? Like, you look at your internal capabilities. So it's a combination of looking at the wording in the standard, but also having the documentation there to substantiate so that, you know, when these pro formas get to the directors, you're not, you know, getting questioned on, okay, do we really have the capabilities in the organizations? Like, for some of these very mature organizations, does this qualitative assessment, does it fit in with what the outcomes have been?
Yeah, I think probably the only other point to add is, I mean, we spoke at length about sort of where we see it going and, you know, what mature practices look like over time. I think it's pretty evident. You know, like we said, actuaries will have a role to play. I think similarly from an assurance perspective, putting that audit hat on, you know, in all the various areas where there's different quantification or sort of how it all pieces together, just bringing in that sort of holistic understanding across, you know, the full depth of the disclosures, you know, will be the opportunity there for actuaries from that audit assurance perspective as well.